The reading this morning comes from Romans chapter 15, verses 14 to 21. Paul, the minister to the Gentiles. I myself am convinced, my brothers and sisters, that you yourselves are full of goodness, filled with knowledge and competent to instruct one another. Yet I have written you quite boldly on some points to remind you of them again, because of the grace God gave me to be a minister of Jesus Christ to the Gentiles. He gave me the priestly duty of proclaiming the gospel of God so that the Gentiles might become an offering acceptable to God, sanctified by the Holy Spirit. Therefore, I glory in Christ Jesus in my service to God. I will not venture to speak of anything except what Christ has accomplished through me in leading the Gentiles to obey God by what I have said and done, by the power of signs and wonders, through the power of the Spirit of God. So, from Jerusalem all the way around to Illyricum, I have fully proclaimed the gospel of Christ. It has always been my ambition to preach the gospel where Christ was not known, so that I would not be building on someone else's foundation. Rather, as it is written, those who were not told about him will see, and those who have not heard will understand. This is the word of the Lord.
Good morning, everybody. 2 years ago, when I was back, my role in Nepal was a bit different. So initially when I went out, I was project development manager of a school. Actually, I'll introduce the family. If you go back to that photo. Sorry, just to say, a lot of you all know who we are, but for those who don't, there's Caleb, who's 12, he'll be coming into membership this morning, Helen, Esther, me, and Karis. Caleb, Karis, and Esther go to the school that I work at called KISC, which is Kathmandu International Study Center. So I was project manager for KISC when I first went out to look principally for a new site and a new school. We're in a carpet factory, converted carpet factory at this moment, with very little space. So we really needed something more and needed to fundraise. But then when I went back 2 years ago, there was a bit of a reshuffle, so I became director at KISC, so my responsibilities changed a bit. So with another BMS worker called Dan Parnell, he's the school director, because I know nothing about academics. So I do anything non-academic, so business, looking for a site, communications, fundraising and things. And then we have a Nepali man called Kim. He deals with the government, and we have a teacher training program. So we partner with schools throughout Nepal, trying to raise the standards of education, and Kim runs that program. And we don't just go on a one-off. We partner with visiting them 4 times a year and really drawing alongside them just to try and raise the standard, because education in rural parts of Nepal is challenging for them. So that's my role. Helen has been teaching medical students. She was a GP in the UK, so she's able to transfer her training to medical students and to qualified GPs over in Nepal. And to help with that, she's studying a master's in medical education, as well as helping out with the local church that we're part of, a Nepali church. So she helps with the Sunday school, training the Sunday school teachers in Nepal, and doing Didi Baini groups, which is a women's Bible study group. I won't go to a lot of detail about Nepal, because I think you probably heard it before, but in brief, Nepal was very much a closed country to the until the 50s. There was no foreign influence. There wasn't really a church in Nepal. And development is very difficult in Nepal. It's very hilly. I think I can say that. You have the Himalayas. The middle mountains are 6,000 to 8,000 square feet, and then you have a very flat bit at the beginning. And they say if you flatten out Nepal, it would be the size of Canada. We haven't tried that yet, but it is very flat, sorry, very hilly. The annual average income is less than $800 a year, and it's very much an agricultural income that they get. So there are lots of challenges in Nepal, especially in the rural areas. But things were compounded further by the events of the 25th of April last year, which I'm sure you probably saw on the news. And we just want to share something of that event and the sort of events and the following of the last year and how we saw God in those events. So Helen and I are going to share the pulpit a bit. And so I'll ask Helen to come up now.
So I don't know if you remember where you were on the 25th of April last year. Unless it's your birthday or wedding anniversary, you probably don't remember. But I don't think we'll ever forget. We were in our church, Nepali church. Saturday is the only weekend day in Nepal. So schools are open on Sunday. Most people go to work on a Sunday as well. So Saturday is the one day weekend. So for Nepali Christians, if you're going to church, Saturday will be the day that you do it. So we were in church, and this is our church. So the pink building, it looks very good on the photograph. I'm not quite sure whether it's Photoshop, but it really doesn't look that shiny in real life. So there's accommodation for the pastor and his family upstairs. And then the roof that you can see sloping on the left-hand side of that photo, that's the main church hall, a single-story building. And so that's where the church was meeting. And then at the bottom of that pink building is where the children's group meets. And so you can see the children meeting in the hall there, and you can see Kara stands out quite well. So on Saturday the 25th, like we have here, the children had been in for the worship, and then I'd gone out with the children's group into our hall. And we were working on a series about the life of Joseph. And we got to the part in Joseph's life where he was put into prison. And I was talking with the children about what it must be like in prison. And we decided it was pretty dark and scary and lonely and probably a bit smelly as well. And that it wasn't much fun for Joseph. His family think he's dead. He's been abandoned, falsely accused, and put away, and the key has virtually been thrown away. But it says in Genesis, the Lord was with Joseph in prison. And we talked about the difference that would make. It didn't change his physical circumstances, but that when you're frightened and when you're alone, having someone come alongside you makes all the difference. And so for Joseph, knowing that God was with him in prison actually changed his environment and changed his perspective. He knew that God was with him. And we talked about how Joseph was a good man. He didn't deserve to be in prison. But that because of sin in the world, bad things happen to good people. But that the promise we have in Jesus is that no matter what happens, God will be with us, even when we're frightened or afraid. And I just finished saying that when suddenly there was this kind of rumbling sound, like an aeroplane starting to take off on the roof of the building. It started gently, and then it got louder, like an amazing roar. And then there's a little bit of shaking, and then suddenly, violently, whoops. Sorry, I didn't quite mean to recreate the earthquake for you up here. Anyway, that's what happened. Sorry, Roger, I know you're not here. I'm just trashing your church. So that's what happened, shaking violently like that. And we realized very quickly that this was an earthquake and not a small one. It was a big one. So our training kicked in, and we remembered drop, cover, hold. Get down on the floor, get underneath something so you don't have things falling in your head, and hold on tight. Unfortunately, we were in a totally bare room. There was nothing to get under. There was nothing to hold on to. And so we huddled together. I had the children in, those who hadn't run out with the Nepali teachers, and I put my arms over them, and we sat on the floor, and the room pitched up and down. And we had double doors at the back of the hall. I'm now paddling in this at the front. We had double doors at the back of the hall like you do here. And it went from the doors shut, like yours are, to swinging wide open and then slamming shut as the room pitched backwards, then swinging forward and then slamming shut as the room pitched up and down. And on the third time that the door swung open, Angus's head appeared through the doorway with the youth pastor, and they said, "You've got to get out." And I said, "No, we need to stay put." I decided that the middle of an earthquake was a good point to have an argument. Because I was thinking, if we move when the ground is shaking, more people get injured trying to run whilst the ground is shaking. But Angus said, that building, that three-story building that you just saw, or under which we were sitting, he said, it's swaying like that. It might come down. We have got to get out. So if you just go back, Angus, the picture of the church. So we filed out with the children. You can see there's a little archway. The church is kind of cut into the hill. So we filed out up that archway onto this little patch of grass, which is probably maybe two-thirds of the size of this platform. And we came up onto the grass, and most of the church by that time had come out. And so there were about 250 people out on this patch of grass, and we sat down together, and the children of the class all sat around me, and I said to them, do you remember what we were just learning in our lesson? Do you remember about Joseph in prison and how God was with him even when he was afraid? Well, God is right with us now in the middle of this earthquake. We don't need to be afraid. And that really is the story of our experience of the earthquake. It was scary. It was loud. It was like nothing we'd ever experienced. And yet, God was with us right there, tangibly, all the way through it. There's a picture that Esther has done of the earthquake, which I think really clearly illustrates what it was like. She said it was like being on a boat, being pitched down and up and down. And also that the ground is no longer solid, like trying to walk on a bouncy castle. You put your foot down and you think it should be solid, but it gives way under you. And then your other leg gives way the other way. That was just what it was like. And an earthquake is not like a one-off event. It's like throwing a huge rock into the middle of a lake. There's the initial splash, but then there's all the little ripples that come after and after. And so we sat on the grass thinking, oh, wow, that was a big earthquake. And all we could see was the little bit of land around us. We didn't know what had happened wider across the city. But already our heads are going thinking that was a big one. We don't know how big, but the city could be really badly damaged. We need to make plans for what we're going to do. And the plan had always been that in the event of a major incident, we would group at KISC, the school that Angus works at, because they have a big sports site, and we would all meet there, and that would be our muster point. But we were about a 15, 20-minute walk from there, and that involved walking down streets with tall buildings. And so we didn't want to do that while the earth was still shaking. So we made an agreement between us that when we got to the point where there were no aftershocks for 20 minutes, then we would go to the school. Well, 4 hours it took. So every 10 seconds, every 30 seconds, there was another aftershock. Then every minute. Then we got to 5 minutes. We thought, okay, maybe this is it. Then there'd be another one. Every 10 minutes, Caleb was getting fed up. It was now getting to 2 o'clock in the afternoon, and we've been there since 9:30 in the morning. Everyone's hungry. We were a bit cold. And we were thinking, okay, we need to make plans for tonight. We need to get food. We need to get to safety. But every time we kept thinking about moving, another one would come, and the ground would pitch and roll, the birds would take off, the buildings would sway ominously, and the dogs would go nuts. So 4 hours, and then we left the church and headed up to the school. And those are some of the sights that we saw on the way up. And the thing that you noticed most of all was that it seemed almost quite random which buildings were totally unaffected, and the neighbor had completely collapsed. And as with all natural disasters, it was the poor who were disproportionately badly affected. Those who had the older style buildings, those that had built with stone and mud rather than bricks and concrete, their buildings were destroyed. So we made it up to KISC. This is the school building on the left. And then on the right is the basketball court, which was built to be earthquake-proof. And had only opened in the last 3 years. And so that became not only our home, but the home of many of the KISC families and teachers and our neighbors. There were nearly 300 people who based themselves there. And so in the immediate aftermath of the earthquake, Angus and his colleague Dan became directors of a refugee camp, internally displaced people camp. And so we're there with nearly 300 people with 4 toilets, with no electricity, with water in tanks, but it has to be pumped from the tanks, with uncertainty about whether the airport will be open. We have been told that on all projections, an earthquake more than a 6 would knock out the single strip of airport in Kathmandu and would also knock out the road that links Kathmandu to India, along which 80% of the supplies come. And so we've got 300 people and we've got supplies, but we're not quite sure how long this has all got to last. This could be weeks before help can come in terms of helicopters if the airport and the road have been knocked out. And so it was an incredibly busy time for Angus, trying to set up processes and systems in place for making sure that people were safe, that they had communications, that they could charge their mobile phones in order to contact family, and also to make sure that there was some sort of form of order and structure in the camp. And it was also like living on your nerves. I don't know if you've ever been in a hotel when the fire alarm has gone off in the middle of the night, and you wake up with that, and you draw your heart. And I made you all jump then. Well, that's what it's like. Sorry. That's what it's like waking up with an aftershock. The ground is shaking. You're already, your heart's over 100. And you wake up like that and the adrenaline's coursing through your body. And then once it's stopped, it takes a good 20 minutes, half an hour, before your heart rate's back down and you're ready to go back to sleep. And every night we were getting those, 3-4 times a night. And the children would wake up and we'd have to calm them down and we'd all have to try and get back to sleep because all 300 people have woken up outside and it's trying to get them all back quiet again. So we were exhausted and living under a state of high tension. Although we were safe, it was a very high tension situation. And yet we were very, very aware of God's presence, his peace, and his holding us. We didn't have access to internet, but Angus had just got a 4G phone and so was occasionally able to get onto the mobile network, and messages were pouring in that we're praying for you, we're praying for you, we're praying for you. And we really felt that being lifted up by our family around the world and God carrying us no matter what was going on. And not only was there the actual aftershocks that were ongoing, it was the rumor mill and the fear. Our Nepali neighbors and friends had no understanding of why this earthquake had happened. When I spoke to my friend and language teacher, she said that the gods were angry because the buildings had got higher than the temples, so the gods wanted to level them all. And so that kind of fear and vengeful God that they serve, there's no peace there, there's no reassurance, and there's no hope. And so we were trying to explain to people why earthquakes happen. They even put on a geography lesson using a Ferrero Rocher, explaining about tectonic plates and the layers of the Earth's crust, just to say this wasn't some kind of supernatural occurrence. It was actually rationally explainable, and there was a model for what would happen in terms of aftershocks. But there was absolute fear and terror. And social media can be wonderful for reassuring people you're safe, but it also is a great rumor mill. And so there would be rumors going around saying on Tuesday there's going to be a 12.5 earthquake. And so even the slightest tremor would send our neighbors screaming into the streets, even though the Richter scale doesn't go that high. And so we were really very much aware of the fear that was around us. Everyone was exhausted and people were very frightened. And so we had to take a decision. Did we stay or did we go? And we very, very clearly felt, this is our home. How can we leave them when they need us now? Some people did leave. In fact, many left, and we have absolutely no judgment on them. Everyone has to make their own decision for their own family. But we really clearly felt God say, this is home. This is where you need to be right now. And in fact, we felt like God was reminding us of the name that we call Jesus at Christmas, Emmanuel, God with us. And that actually part of our role was to walk alongside our neighbors and our friends in the midst of all of this fear and to bring some of Jesus' peace and hope and light and encouragement. And actually in our neighborhood, there are quite a lot of foreigners because there are lots of INGOs based there, but many left, in fact most left. And so as we walked down the street, we really stood out and people came up to us that we didn't know and said, where do you work? You haven't left. Who do you work for? And colleagues of Angus's wept, saying, thank you for staying. It means so much to us that you didn't leave. And my neighbor, Rabisha, she said to me, you're so brave. And I said, I am not brave. She said, you are brave. And it gave opportunity to be able to share about the God that we have who isn't vengeful, who's loving and peaceful and actually right there with us in the midst of the fear. And I said, look, Jesus is here. He will answer when you call. He will give you the peace and the grace that you need. That's how I can cope with every day. And she said, oh, but Christians died. And they did. And because it was a Saturday, actually many Christians died because they were in churches that collapsed. But I was able to say to her, but that's okay. My life is in his hands, whether it's now or in heaven. That's just geography. This country or a better country. Hindus don't have that. There's no certainty. There's no eternal security. And so to be able to share the hope that we have in Jesus was a real privilege. And there were many ways in which we were able to see God's grace even through a terrible situation. There was another instance when we went to the hospital. I went down, not on the day of the earthquake, but the next day. Oh, this is Karis's drawing of us at the basketball court. And you can see on that picture that it's a bit slower. You can see on the picture that it's raining. And the first night after the earthquake, we're under the shelter and it's raining. And I lay there going, oh, come on. You know, it's not like Wales where that's a normal occurrence. In Nepal, it rains in monsoon and for a week in January. This was April. It should not have been raining. And I was like, okay, come on, God. This is not funny. We've got shelter. There are people out in the fields who've got houses destroyed, no shelter, and now it's raining. And yet, we heard afterwards that there were many who were trapped in buildings who were rescued 2-3 days later. And the fact that it rained meant that they had drinking water that they wouldn't have had. That actually, even in that, God's grace was evident. But this is Esther saying, I want a cuddle. And me saying, we're safe now. That's us in the basketball shelter. So when I went to the hospital the next day, the building itself was, this is Patton Hospital, was built in the 80s to be earthquake-proof and actually was incredibly well, undamaged. There were some cracks, but the engineers had inspected and said it was fine. But needless to say, nobody wanted to be in it, and so the hospital had been completely evacuated. And there are two big army tents that were erected outside of the hospital. But even these tell a story. We had had a major incident drill 4 months before the earthquake. Now, we don't have them very often, and we'd simulated an explosion in a factory and hundreds of casualties. And on that day, it had taken them 4 hours to locate the emergency army tent. It had taken 2 days to erect it, because you know what it's like camping, and this is without instructions and which pole goes where. On the day of the earthquake, that was up and running within 2 hours. And that front one is our orthopedic operating theater, and the second one was our labor ward and cesarean section theater, because babies come, earthquakes or no earthquakes. And so when I arrived, the triage system was set up. The medical students had wheelchairs waiting, trolleys waiting. It was incredibly well organized. I was so, so proud of them. And it was, I'm sure, because we'd had this practice 4 months before. And so even in the timing of that, we were able to see God's grace at work in the situation. But the hospital had thousands of walking wounded on the first day. But after that, within the Kathmandu Valley, very few people were pulled alive from the rubble. And it was very, very quiet. Thousands left the city and left the country. And in the country itself, over 9,000 people died. And nearly 500,000 lost their homes and were living and still are living in temporary accommodation. So I'm going to hand over to Angus for a moment now. Sorry, you've got to paddle up here through the little puddle I've created.
They didn't teach at Mission College about how to deal with the aftermath of an earthquake or, you know, how to help your staff through the situation. The school was, the main building was okay, but the school hall, one of the main walls had fallen down. A lot of the perimeter walls had fallen. One of our smaller buildings, the supporting pillar had cracked to make it unusable, as well as a few water towers had fallen. But also many of our staff, their homes were destroyed. Quite a few rent places, so it was all right. They eventually were able to relocate. But several also had their own homes that they had paid for or they inherited over generations, and their homes were totally destroyed. So we quickly set up a relief fund for the staff, giving them money from the school to just to help them get through day to day and carry out immediate repairs. So we set up a fund. But then a couple of days after the earthquake, the director of SIM, which is serving in Mission, he came into my office and said, so what do you need? I don't know. I haven't thought about it. Engineers, builders, and money. He said, okay, leave that with me. And the next day he came in, he said, right, I've got builders coming over from Australia for you during the school holiday to rebuild everything for you. I said, oh, great. He said, I've got engineers coming, Engineering Ministries International. They have a base in India. They're an international organization of engineers, structural engineers, civil engineers. And a team of them were going to come up, and we had them for 2 days. And in those 2 days, they were able to inspect the school and 50 of our staff's accommodation just to make sure everywhere was safe or to say, yeah, don't go in there if I were you. So it's great to have that. And then he also said you can spend up to $50,000 on repairing the school. Which was just a great relief. And it also meant all the money that we raised through the relief fund, we had done it for the staff and for rebuilding the school. All the money, 100% of it, was able to go to the staff that really needed help to rebuild their homes. We probably gave enough for them to get about halfway, but it was a great start. And many of them are not Christians, so they just really appreciated the support from everybody around the world. So the year continued. The aftershocks continued. On the Richter scale, 4.0, they said that there were over 400 earthquakes in the last year, which is quite a lot. And you have that ongoing stress. There was a lot of support coming in from overseas, but I understand a lot of the international aid groups were not confident to send the money that they'd raised. I understand there's $24 billion waiting to come into the country. But because the country didn't have a constitution, these organizations weren't comfortable sending the money over. So Nepal, having wrangled for 10 years without a constitution, the negotiations have been hitting brick walls every week, it seemed, suddenly launched a constitution, and that came out in September, which was great news, and so it caused a great relief. But unfortunately, it didn't please our large neighbor, India. Because of certain things within the constitution, they weren't happy, and so the border between India and Nepal was blocked. There had been violence on two of the border posts between India and Nepal. And officially, they said, well, there's violence on the border. We're going to close it. But it was only on two borders. I think there are 74 border entries between the two countries. And they basically stopped everything coming in or going out. And as Helen said earlier, 80% of supplies come in to Nepal through India. So that's diesel, petrol, medical supplies, building materials, food. All these things have suddenly stopped. Well, the majority has stopped. They even stopped air freight coming in. So friends run a business, and they had supplies coming in by air, and they thought, well, that should be all right. But they even stopped things at the airport from coming into the country. So we're basically held to ransom. So we rely heavily on diesel to run businesses, to run our school. We all have big generators because through the year we don't have a consistent supply of electricity. During monsoon season, when we have a lot of rain, which runs the hydroelectric dams, we have a lot of, we have 22 hours of power a day. Whereas you get to December, January, and there's not much rain, and so we can go 18 hours without power in a day, which is quite hard to run a business in the school, so we all rely on big generators to supply electricity. And suddenly the diesel and petrol supply has stopped. And they estimate that 4,000 businesses had to shut. 400,000 people lost their jobs, having had an earthquake just a few months before. So it made things very difficult. Cooking gas was another thing. We all use the sort of Caligas heaters to cook. Many people can afford to have one, but they can't have a spare. We had a few spare, so we were able to cook during that time, although it's getting pretty close to us running out as well. But people had to cook on open fires in the middle of a city where there aren't that many trees that they could use. And then we had a particularly cold winter. So you imagine people in temporary shelters, sleeping under tarpaulings. They're still sleeping under tarpaulings. Caleb and I, just before we came back here, which was May. So in April, we were cycling out just in a village a few miles out of Kathmandu. And the houses they use for pigs normally, we saw families still living in the pig houses. So you have a tough winter living under temporary accommodation. It just made the whole year particularly difficult. And it wasn't until, I think it was the end of March, or the beginning of March, in March, that the blockade ended. But it still hasn't recovered properly yet. And sadly, through the whole uncertainty of the situation, a lot of vulnerable people got trafficked. They estimate a few thousand people, women and children, got trafficked overseas. And many lost the sort of young people. In some areas, it's very much a hand-to-mouth existence. They need an income, and with many losing their jobs, they need to find work, they need to find money quickly. And going overseas is a great way to do that. That's one of the country's major sources of income, is people working overseas and sending them money back. And so many of those young people you'd hope could rebuild the villages, rebuild the country, have had to go overseas just in order for them and their family to survive. So it has made it very difficult. And then for us at KISC, in November, we were served notice by the landlord of the sports site. So we had a nice new football ground. We had that basketball court that we all slept on and a parking area. And so we were served notice, and within 3 months we had to demolish that. We just lost half our site and our security if there were another earthquake. So it was a bit of a tough year. But through it all, there has been hope, fortunately, otherwise it'd be hard to get up in the mornings. Excitingly, in March, we were able to sign on a new site for the Kisk. We're going to have a whole new site about 7 kilometres away from where we are currently, and we're going to rebuild the primary and the secondary school. We'll have a nice football pitch and a basketball court and parking, lovely views, cleaner air. We'll be up in the hills a little bit. We're going to have, we're owned by a Nepali NGO. They're going to come with us, their head office. They run hospitals and schools, and one of their other projects is a special needs school. They have 3 special needs schools around Nepal, and one of them, we're going to have them come up on the site with us as well, which is really exciting. And we'll have our teacher training program there. And we'll be partnering with the school that has the land already, and that's a school for underprivileged children in the local community. 85% of them live in orphanages. They're not all orphans, but many families can't afford to keep their children, so they send them to orphanages. And so this school helps to support that school. So it would be great to partner with them and influence not only the international mission community, but in particular this local school and the teachers there. Our teacher training program after the earthquake was able to partner with more schools to help train them deal with children who have suffered with a major trauma. So it was great to see that, and they really appreciated the way that we were able to help them in helping their students and their children. And BMS, through partnering with INF and UMN, they were able to help with relief work. So I think they raised about 600,000 in the UK here. 200,000 of that will be used for the initial relief, and then 400,000 is being used for rebuilding. So it's an ongoing project. It's going to take a long time to rebuild, but BMS, INF, UMN are there for the long term, supporting the country. And then what's really been encouraging is seeing how the local church, the Nepali church, has stepped up. They're very much focused on evangelism, rightly so, but they were there thinking, why are we waiting for foreign aid to come all the time? Why don't we do something? We have a 4x4 vehicle. We can get supplies. We can get food. So straight away, our local church and many other local churches would go out into the villages every day, taking tarpaulings, tin sheets, dalbat, everything out to the villages. And it's really been great to see them take on the whole holistic gospel, not just the word, but it's word and action. And really supporting the church. And in a few villages, the sister churches were the only buildings left in the whole village where our village would be wiped out, because they're reasonably built buildings. And so that became the community hub. That became the place where everyone could get food, could get shelter. And some are even being used now as schools because the schools got destroyed. I mean, just as an aside, it was great that it was on a Saturday, because if it were any other day, it would have been a school day, and they estimate 16,000 classrooms were destroyed during the earthquake. And you think if there are children in those schools and classes, the death toll would have been very different. So Nepal is trying to rise from the rubble. It is an ongoing challenge, and there's a long way to go. So I'll just pass on to Helen now.
So 1 week after the earthquake, the following Saturday, we were back at church. Needless to say, nobody wanted to go indoors, so we had set up a tent on the grass outside, and we had our meeting. And after the church, I was due to lead the women's Bible study group, and I put on one side what I'd planned and said, we need to talk about what's just happened. We need to talk about this week. And I said to them, I want you to think about the promises of God that you always loved, what it was that you hung on to, what you would remind yourself, what you'd tell people when they're going through difficult times. And I want you to say, ask yourself, is that still true? Because if our faith only works on a good day, then there's not much point. We might as well pack up and go home. And so they sat and thought for a minute, and then they started sharing with their neighbors. And then one by one, they shared with each other. And they said things like, I always used to love when it says in Isaiah about how underneath are the everlasting arms. But this week, I have known what it's been to be carried by God on his everlasting arms. Or when Jesus talks about how he has us inscribed on the palms of his hands. He has my name inscribed on the palms of his hands. I've always loved that verse. But this week, when the ground was shaking, I could know that he could not have me any closer. He has my name inscribed with nail marks on his hands. And every single one of the women there was able to say, yes, I was terrified. Yes, it's been terrible, but God has never been so real or so close to me as he has been this week during everything that's gone on. And we were able to encourage one another, to remind ourselves of God's faithfulness and his compassion. The fact that he sees what we're going through, he knows what it's like, and he weeps with us. He's right there in the midst of the pain and the suffering. And that no matter what, our lives are safe in his hands, whether now or in eternity. And we ended by reading a psalm that when I finally got internet access, so many people had emailed to me. And I'm going to read part of it to you now. Psalm 46. God is our refuge and strength, an ever-present help in trouble. Therefore, we will not fear though the earth gives way and the mountains fall into the heart of the sea. Though its waters roar and foam, and the mountains quake with their surging. The Lord Almighty is with us. The God of Jacob is our fortress. We have seen the mountains quake and tremble. We have felt the earth give way. But we can stand here today and say to you that through it all, our God was with us, that he is faithful. He is powerful, and he is so close to those who are in pain and are suffering. And he is willing to hold and to comfort those who let him. You know, during the tremors when we sat on the grass outside of church for 4 hours, waiting for it all to just calm down a little bit, Esther, our youngest, sat on my lap. And she sat there with her feet curled up and her hands in front of her. She wouldn't touch the ground, hoping that if she didn't touch it, she wouldn't feel it. So she sat there like this, with both of my arms wrapped around her. She wouldn't let me let go. And every time I tried to ease one arm, just to lean back a bit, she would grab it and pull it straight back round for 4 hours. And as I sat there holding her as tight as I could so that she knew I was right there, I knew that God was holding us just the same, tightly, with both arms. It couldn't have been any closer. Now, you may not have been through an earthquake, and I hope you don't. It's not something to put on your bucket list. But actually, earthquakes happen in everybody's life in a different way. Maybe somebody you loved has betrayed you. You've suffered a crushing bereavement, or a terminal diagnosis, or abuse, hurt, redundancy, loss, where everything that you thought was safe and strong and secure has shaken and crumbled to dust around you. Your world has shaken and will never be the same again, just like Nepal. Jesus wants to meet you in the rubble. He wants to hold you as you grieve. He is right there in the midst of the desolation and the pain. And if you let him, he will be your peace and your comfort. The aftershocks may still come, as they still do for us. But over time, they will get smaller and smaller, and further apart, until one day you and Jesus are ready to start building again. Not the same as you were, not as if it never happened, but beauty from ashes, oil of joy from mourning, restoring the broken walls, a testament to the God who never leaves us, no matter how dark the night or how deep the pit. I pray that this will be the story of Nepal as she starts to rebuild in the future. But I also pray that this will be the story of each of our lives as we allow God to brush us off, to stand us up, and to rebuild again. Amen.
Let's bless one another with a grace before we leave. May the grace of God, Lord Jesus Christ, love of God, and the fellowship of the Holy Spirit be with us all evermore. Amen.